This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. The Kalamazoo Valley Museum is marking Valentine's Day with a program this Sunday on biracial marriages. Michigan repealed its laws making biracial marriages illegal in 1883. It was not until 1967 that the U.S. Supreme Court struck down such laws in all states. Biracial Marriages, Narratives from Kalamazoo begins at 1:30 Sunday afternoon in the Mary Jane Stryker Theater. Elspeth Inglis is Assistant Director of Programs, and Felix Brooks is Director of Diversity and Inclusion at the Kalamazoo Valley Museum. Thank you both for being here.
Our pleasure.
Thank you. And I should add to that, you know, because it's new now. You didn't warn me. I'm also now the Director of International Admission. So
okay.
My president will be happy if I put that little plug in there. So.
At Kalamazoo Valley Community
Kalamazoo
College,
Valley.
Right?
Correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Why look at biracial marriages this year on Valentine's Day?
I'm going to let Felix take that one, really, but it's all around us. I mean, it's something that has been talked about. It's something that recently the Loving versus Virginia case was brought to light again when the Supreme Court was looking at same-sex marriages. So that got us thinking maybe we could do a program that gives a little historical background and then gives some lived experiences as well.
And for me, there's a personal aspect to this, and that's why Elspeth sort of brought me on. You know, I'm in an interracial marriage, and my daughter, my youngest daughter as well, is also in an interracial marriage. And my family history, according to my mom and what I've been able to find out, is checkered with this sort of thing. So this is not anything new for my family. It may be a different experience in a different time, but it's just home for me. And this has been my lived experience for, well, it's going all the way back to my first marriage in 1982 and my second marriage in 1998. Both been interracial marriages, so I've been a bridge builder as far as that's been concerned, so for many years.
Well, if we look back at Michigan's history when it comes to mixed race or biracial marriages, what can we say in kind of some broad strokes about where the state has been and where it ended up present day?
Well, I'm not an expert in this, but in a cursory bit of research I discovered, as you stated at the beginning of the program, that until, I think the date was
1883,
Michigan, like so many other states in the United States, had anti-miscegenation laws, you know, laws against interracial marriage or, frankly, interracial sex. And many of those laws were on the books before the American Revolution, actually. I haven't discovered why Michigan voluntarily gave up that law, but the state saw fit to do that in the 1880s. And then we have this little bit of history that we'll talk about later regarding the couple in Bangor who married 2 years after that.
And I think the anomaly in this, which I've always found interesting because I'm a big history buff, is that we passed the 13th and 14th Amendments during the Civil War. So you would have thought that that would have laid the case to rest because those were the equal protection amendments that were passed by the national government. You would have thought that would have took all this away from the states in terms of their ability to regulate this sort of thing. But obviously that was not the case. You know, so that's what I find interesting.
And equal protection under the law was one of the arguments for lifting all bans on same-sex marriage, that same-sex couples had equal protection under the law. But you're right. In this case, it didn't seem to fully ripple across the country.
It didn't translate to marriage. It translated in a lot of other respects, but not to marriage. And that's what I found to be a really interesting, you know, historical anomaly. So,
and the consequence of breaking those laws up until the Loving case in 1967 was jail time. You actually could go to prison for marrying somebody of a different race.
But in Michigan, we do know that there was a couple in Bangor who married not very long after the law in Michigan was repealed. So tell us a little bit what we know about a gentleman named Ed Cable and his bride, Anna DeNoon.
Ed Cable was an African-American man who was very well respected in the community. He was a businessman, and he was well-liked. When he and Anna decided to get married, they went to a church, and the minister there refused to marry them. So they found another church where the minister was willing to marry them. And it's interesting that the newspapers of the time, they do pick up on this. It's not a lot of hyperbole, but one newspaper did express sympathy to the parents, Anna's parents, to her family.
That she had entered into this marriage with this African-American.
Correct. They lived happily, it seems, in Bangor until Anna died, and they never had children.
We should also note Ed Cable was, by all accounts, from what we can tell looking back, a pretty well-respected businessman in Bangor at the time. So that might have changed somewhat the view here. If Ed Cable had been, you know, just kind of someone who bagged groceries or something like that, maybe the view of him would have been somewhat different than someone who owned a business.
You mean maybe the community would have been less tolerant of that union? We can only conjecture, I think that's a pretty fair bet.
Yeah, I would think that this status had played a role in the support that he had from other members of the community that was also helpful, because as we know, that's not always the case. I mean, the reason for these laws was this belief that if you were white, you were superior. And so to marry somebody of a different color or a different race meant that you were making your race impure. So that was, so there was a lot of deeply held religious beliefs around that and a lot of deeply held social beliefs around those narratives.
Which, of course, we know is ridiculous on many counts.
Right. But what does what we know, what do these newspaper accounts and you know, again, maybe the limited view that we have here tell us about that time? We're talking now the 1880s. And what do they tell us about today in terms of how these people were viewed then and how they still might be viewed now?
Well, I would think that even then, people don't get the wrong conception, that there were pockets of tolerance that existed. That had to have been the case for these folks to be able to marry and there not to be a particularly violent outcome. That might not have been the case if it had been in the South or in the West. So there had to have been something about that particular community that said, you know what, we may not necessarily agree with this, but we're gonna tolerate it and we're not going to retaliate against him or his family or her and her family. So
I think the reference to the regional aspect of it is a valid one. It was much less tolerated in the South. Even though, of course, we know that there were all the interracial unions from time immemorial, really.
Have happened.
Yes.
And I think I think Bangor, if I'm not mistaken, was also part of the Underground Railroad. So you got that history there, too, of generations of folks who had grown up around this area being an area that had been of help to the African American slaves who had been on the run. So that whole Bangor, Niles, you know, those covert areas, those areas all play a central role with respect to the Underground Railroad. So I suspect that there were some thought processes that had grown up generationally around these sorts of things as well.
I am curious, however, why the state of Michigan voluntarily, at the time, as far as I know, there was no political or even social pressure for the state to eliminate that law from its books. And I don't know if anybody has done any research. I couldn't quickly find anything published. I'd like to know the answer to that.
One thing I noticed in just a list of states when laws went into effect and when they were repealed, Michigan's was on the books a relatively short period of time. Now, relatively is still over 40 years.
Yes.
But in other states, this had been on the books going back to the 1700s and then was there up until 1967 when the Supreme Court struck it down. I suppose there is some material there that a good historian might get at.
There must be something out there. Debates on the floor of the House and the Senate are recorded, so somebody could do that research.
What does this story, first of all, Ed Cable and Anna Dunoon, but also more broadly of mixed race, biracial marriages in Michigan and elsewhere, how does that sort of fit with today where the U.S. Supreme Court has struck down laws which ban same-sex marriage, but there is still a debate about what people should have to do in terms of providing services? Should they have to provide lodging? Should they have to design a wedding cake for somebody? What are the parallels?
Well, I think a couple things, and with respect to the whole interracial piece, is that if you look at the demographic maps of this country in the 1960s and what they look like now, there is a significant change in what those maps look like. In fact, I think I've talked to you about this before, Elsbeth. USA Today and Starbucks have this campaign called Race Together. Now, there were some parts of that campaign that didn't go over really well, but one of the big things that they introduced was the diversity index. And they asked a specific question. They had three maps, a map of the country in 1960, a map of the country in 2010, and a map of what they think the country's gonna look like in 2060. And what you can see in those maps is the change in terms of how our country looks. Because the question that they asked was, what are the chances that the person sitting next to you is gonna be somebody different from you? So you look at a map from 1960, chance was not that great. You look at a map from 2010, very much different. So now we're living in a country where we're much more in close proximity to folks that are different from us. And if we're gonna progress in a way that makes us this shining city on a hill, I think this has been one of the responses is that people have become more and more accepting of these sorts of unions. And in fact, the younger generation of kids tend not to think about it the way, say, my parents' generation thought about it, which was completely different. So attitudes have changed. And I see the same thing in an accelerated way with same-sex marriage. Because if you look at where we were 10 years ago and where we are today, a sea change. But if you talk to young people, they'll look at you like, well, what are you guys even making this out of an issue about this? That's as one of my daughters say, that's an old person issue.
I think the parallels are strong. I think what Felix just said about it accelerating, the change is accelerating, has got to do with media today, how much more quickly people have access to information and can talk to people or converse with people over great expanses of area, space. So our world has shrunk in many ways, and I hope that it makes us a little more sympathetic to people who are different from us, because we hear more, we see more about their day-to-day lives than we might have 20, 30, 40 years ago.
And we know that in the rest of the westernized world, these are not big issues for those countries. You know, right. Great Britain, Sweden, Norway, you know, places in Europe, these are not issues for them. They've gone way past that. And like Elsbeth said, with social media now we also see that we were behind, you know, the learning curve on this as opposed to being ahead of it, which the United States has always built itself as being this progressive country. So
there's also the parallel in terms in how this broke down legally, although on a somewhat different timetable, that you have states coming along and saying, we're going to strike down these laws. And ultimately, you get a case before the Supreme Court, and seemingly at a time when it was more politically viable, even though the court's supposed to be insulated from politics. But ultimately, I think we see that both of these cases came at a time when people were viewing the issue of race in the 60s differently, yep, and the issue of same-sex marriage in the United States differently in 2015.
Because I think you have the Loving case coming, what, three years after the Civil Rights Amendment passed, so you got that backdrop going on, and you got a lot of people saying to the government, well, if you passed the Civil Rights Act, why did you still have these antiquated laws on the books about marriage? You know, and that was part of the protest and part of the, you know, people should be judged by the content of their character. That's, you know, part of that argument there.
Is there any part in here where you found the argument of religion as sort of the pushback against allowing marriages of people from different races, the way that we now find it in same-sex marriages?
I think historically there was, yes. It's interesting. I think it is an evolutionary process, an evolution of the mind and heart, perhaps, we could say. And, you know, Southwest Michigan is not isolated. We're not alone in this. And in fact, for about 2 years, I've been part of an international museum community online that is looking at issues of equity within the work of museum professionals. So it isn't only us. We may make more of a big deal about it than other cultures, but I think there's a kind of a whole world movement towards or scrutiny of practices around equity and diversity and inclusivity.
And those are big pieces, because if you think about the history, particularly the religious history around this issue, you, as Ta-Nehisi Coates said, you got to go back to what happened before. And so what happened before is we had 250 years of slavery, followed by Jim Crow, followed by separate but equal. Well, all of those things play into that equation of marriage, because if those are the law, those things are the law of the land, formally or informally in a lot of states, you knew that marriage was going to be something that was going to have to wait. It was not going to be something that was going to be front and center. And most of the justification for slavery was based on religion. So then how do you allow people to marry? If you're holding all these people as slaves and you got Jim Crow going on and you got separate but equal, then it just seems that, you know, that marriage would be something on that continuum that you're not even gonna think about having happen. And that's why they stayed that way for such a long period of time, particularly in the South.
So if somebody were to have some time Sunday and they can get down to the Kalamazoo Valley Museum, what exactly will they see and take part in if they make it to this program on biracial marriages?
We'll have a panel from KVCC led by Kate Ferraro, who is a sociology instructor and she's teaching a class on race right now, I believe. We have an English instructor, Carl Ross, who is, I think he's going to try to get his students involved by having them write about other mm-hmm. people's lived experiences in terms of interracial marriages. And we'll have Felix, who'll be there as well.
Felix, I'm going to go to you here for kind of a last word, because as you said, this is part of your life story here. So we're talking about maybe the longer look at history, but from a maybe shorter lens, you know, you said your first marriage was in 1982.
Yep.
Well, that's 30 plus years to look back on. Do you see a big change in attitudes that people have towards marriages of people from different races now than they did back in the early 80s?
I can tell you that the looks that we as a couple used to get in the early 80s, we don't see that anymore. I mean, I rarely ever read people's body language or get what I call a disdainful look, whereas that was the norm back then. I mean, my wife and I, at that time, when we met in 1979, we were both in college. And just to be out in public, you're going to be scrutinized. I mean, luckily for us, that, you know, we were pretty, in terms of our mindset, we knew what we were getting into. We understood that this was going to be the case. But I can tell you now, that's no longer the case. I walk up to my grandson and my son-in-law, who's white, yesterday at a restaurant in Barnes & Noble's bookstore. Nobody even looks. And clearly, I'm much darker than my little blonde-haired grandson, and nobody even thinks about it now. Just from a visceral standpoint, you can tell that it's changed. People's attitudes, they're much more accepting of this now. This is much, much more normal for them to see in their lives than it was when I first, you know, was involved in this way back in the day. So,
Felix and Elspeth, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Biracial Marriages, Narratives from Kalamazoo begins at 1:30 Sunday afternoon in the Mary Jane Stryker Theater at the Kalamazoo Valley Museum. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.